You love podcasts, the stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you 3 free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast, now with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.
Today on Happy Sad Confused, Toni Collette on perhaps the performance of her career in Hereditary. Hey guys, I'm Josh Horowitz. Welcome to another edition of Happy Sad Confused, my little old podcast where I talk to big old movie stars and filmmakers about their projects and lives. And I'm very pleased to say that today's episode is a first timer to Happy Sad Confused. First time I think I've ever chatted with her, Toni Collette, one of our greatest actors on the planet. I feel very comfortable in saying that, especially when you take a look at the filmography for a second. You take a look back at all the varied work that Toni Collette has done over the years, and Oscar nominated for The Sixth Sense, but that's really just the tip of the iceberg. From Muriel's Wedding, The Little Miss Sunshine, In Her Shoes, a lot of underrated smaller films in there too, and now starring in the new film from A24, our favorite little studio that could, the crazy, oh my God, drama, horror, thriller, suspense. It's hard to pin down. It's a lot of things. Hereditary is the movie. You've probably, if you listen to this podcast, you're a movie fan. And if you're a movie fan, you're kind of in the know on what people are talking about. And people are very much talking about Hereditary. I'd heard the buzz building on this since it premiered at Sundance. I didn't catch it there, sadly. But I finally did a few weeks ago, and it is, it's maybe my favorite movie of the year. It's definitely up there. It's definitely top 10 material, probably for me by the end of the year, safe to say. I want to see it again. It's, you know, it's one of those movies that I don't want to reveal too much about it, but suffice it to say, it is it's a kind of a family drama in some ways. Toni Collette as the matriarch of this family, though her mom at the outset of this film has just passed away, and she is a mother, and she is a wife, and she is plagued by a fractured relationship with her now deceased mother, and struggling with major issues that come up with her own children. And it starts out kind of as a relatable, really sad portrait of a family dealing with grief and loss, and it kind of goes off the rails in many different interesting ways as it progresses. And by the end, it's an intense couple hours at the movies, but it's a very, very impressive piece of work from the first-time filmmaker. That's amazing. And from Toni Collette and this great ensemble of actors, including Gabriel Byrne and Alex Wolff. It's a movie that I think we're going to be talking about throughout the year. So check out Hereditary and check out this conversation with Toni Collette. A couple of disclaimers. You might hear even now, I'm taping this introduction from the confines of my lovely apartment, which is lovely, except that there's constant construction going on around me. You might hear drilling. It's a lot of fun. And I actually taped this conversation with Toni just a couple blocks from my apartment. So you're going to hear the same drilling because there is construction everywhere in my neighborhood. So apologies, a little drilling in the background occasionally, but you're going to hear the delicious, wonderful Australian voice of Toni Collette to soothe you. So it's going to be okay, guys. Beyond that, beyond this conversation and the movie, just to mention a couple other things, if you are an Arrested Development fan, if you've not caught up on the new season, it's quite good. But also, I want to mention it because I did a really fun trivia contest with none other than Will Arnett and Jason Bateman. That was a blast to shoot, and it is currently up on all of MTV's social platforms, on MTV News' Facebook page, on MTV News' YouTube page, Twitter, all that jazz. So look it up. I'm very proud of it. It was a lot of fun to shoot with those two guys. So smart, self-deprecating. Just if you're a Arrested fan, I think you'll dig it. Other than that, not much else to say except that things are going to get a little crazy around my parts the next couple weeks. I'm headed off to Los Angeles soon for my annual trip to the MTV, formerly known as the MTV Movie Awards, now the MTV Movie and TV Awards. I will be there in a big way. Tiffany Haddish is hosting. It should be a lot of fun. A lot of our favorite people are going to be there. Chris Pratt is getting the Generation Award. And I'm also going to be seeing Chris at the Jurassic World premiere, which MTV and I get to host, actually. I'm hosting the red carpet for that next week in Los Angeles. So I'll spread the good word on social media. But it's going to be a live stream, I believe. So you'll be able to watch me talk to everybody from Jeff Goldblum, Bryce Dallas Howard, and, of course, Chris Pratt about Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom. I'm seeing it tonight, actually, and I'm legitimately really excited. I've touted on this podcast and other places how big a fan I am of the director, J.A. Bayona, who did The Impossible and A Monster Calls. So, and I'm hearing good buzz. So fingers crossed, this one's going to be a big, I think it's going to be both a big, fun summer movie, but Bayona's got some style and he can really deal with like heavy emotion too. So I'm hoping for something a little even more special than you might expect from a summer blockbuster. So fingers crossed on that one. As always, please spread the good word of Happy, Sad, Confused. Rate, review, and subscribe on iTunes. Tell your friends, tell your family. That's the way this show gets bigger and better, and we can bring you guests like the great Toni Collette. So without any further ado, let's go to that conversation. Enjoy this chat with Toni, and go see Hereditary out in theaters now in your neighborhood, or if not now, quite soon. Check it out. It's great to meet you. I'm such a fan of yours.
Oh, nice to meet you. Thank you so much.
Yeah, you were just saying, we were comparing notes on
the junket
traversing
experience.
The junket experience. And you're right, because I think, I would think you, having done this once or twice, you can decipher the person that walks in the room that's just sort of like BSing you,
yeah,
and the one that is actually kind of moved.
Genuinely excited.
And this
about
one is like
things.
That. It's crazy. So congratulations.
Oh,
I hope you're
so
enjoying
much.
This crazy ride.
It's interesting. I don't know. I think I've made almost 70 movies. I've been doing this since I was a teenager, and now this year I turned 46, and I have to say, I think this is the first film in my entire career where there's been such a palpable, excited feeling for a film that hasn't even come out yet.
Yeah. There was that, it premiered right at Sundance, right? Is that
it
true?
It did.
Yeah.
I wasn't there. I didn't go to, there were a couple of screenings at Sundance in January, and then it screened at South by Southwest.
Right.
There was also, there have been several screenings since then. But I watched it for the first time a couple of weeks ago at a screening in LA, and then I watched it at the London premiere. I was just saying to my manager, I don't know. I don't think I can watch it tonight. We've got the premiere here in New York, and I love this film, but it's so heavy, and I can't help but when I watch something that I'm into kind of feel what I was feeling on the day. So nice. It's too exhausting.
Yeah. Mm. It's funny because, even the experience of, jaded film critics going into a screening for this one, I saw this a couple weeks back, and I'd been hearing the buzz building for months at these festivals you mentioned, and, I walked into the screening, and I think it's going to be the same for general audiences too, because they're going to have heard a little bit about it, hopefully not too much. I feel like we all walked into the screening room and we were all bracing ourselves together. No, I mean, truly, we were all are we going to get through this? Are we okay? It was actually a really kind of a moment of solidarity among jaded, horrible New York film critics.
I think that's happening for people who are seeing it in general. There's kind of a sense of safety in numbers,
yes,
right? And also, I don't know, certain films kind of lend themselves to a communal experience, and this is one of them. This is certainly something to try and see in the theatre, in the cinema, because, it's not your average film.
No.
And it's funny watching it with an audience because the moments of nervous energy that erupt Just because they need a break from this kind of relentless suspense.
Building tension, et cetera. Yeah.
Amazing to behold. It's totally fascinating and kind of makes it fun.
Definitely.
Yeah.
So, okay, so we're going to come back around, if it's okay, to Hereditary. I do want to talk at length about that. But, like, you know, I've surprisingly never, I think, chatted with you over the years. I've covered movies for years at MTV.
And yeah,
maybe you
have.
Haven't done enough, like, tween comedies for us or something.
What's wrong with me?
No, it's not you. Don't worry. But I have to say, in addition to being a fan of yours, I got a chance to kind of, like, watch and listen to some interviews with you.
Okay.
And I feel like this is on you now. Like, I feel like I already am in love with you as a human being now, beyond as an actor.
Oh my God.
Well, you just seem like a very cool person. Like, you feel like someone it's basically on you the next 40 minutes not to disappoint me, is what I'm saying. I don't want to put pressure, but I kind of do want to put pressure on you. Because, like, one thing that kind of translates in watching you speak and listening to you speak is, you know, you're not too precious about the craft, or you are, but in terms of talking about it, you know, and I feel like, you know, I don't know if there's a differentiation, but like when an actor kind of takes it all, they can take it seriously. You should take your work seriously.
I agree. Yeah.
But in the mysticism around it and kind of like making it a little bit more than it, it's a job like any other job in a way.
Yeah, it's a job and it's just a movie, but I think the difference is when with most jobs you do something outside of yourself, and any artist uses themselves, so it somehow does become a little personal. But yeah, I'm not a fan of really talking about acting simply because I don't quite understand what I'm doing, and I like it that way. I used to try to articulate what it was for people, and felt like I needed to give answers about how I worked and how the process. And I just, you know, there is certainly things I'm aware of and that I attempt to do, but I also like to get out of my own way because I think that's when the best, like most alive moments can happen. It allows for spontaneity. And that's the most exciting part, when a scene kind of takes on an energy of its own, when you're working with someone who's just as present and open and willing to just let go.
Right.
That to me is an exciting day at the office.
And that was probably the experience on XXX Return of Xander Cage, I'm assuming.
Do you know what that was for me? Doing that film. And in fact, I wasn't looking to do anything heavy. I had said to my agent, you know, the films that I love have a certain emotional depth to them. I love funny films. I really appreciate comedy, but it needs to be balanced with poignancy. And so I'd done a couple of films and I just felt like, oh my God, what am I? I'm thinking about it a year and a half later. What is going on here? And I thought the answer is to not be emotional at work. So XXX was an exercise in not being emotional at work for me. And what I realized is that's not very satisfying because I thrive.
You felt attached from it a little bit, or was it? Like,
yeah, that's just like what I thrive on, creating emotional honesty. That's what it is for me. When this came along, I was shooting a kind of light comedy in Paris and having the time of my life. And my agent said, I know you weren't looking to do anything like this, but... And I mean, I couldn't deny it. It was brilliant. And I knew in my heart that I had to do it. And it was just a matter of how to get through it. Yeah. And this is the film, I think, where I learned how to take care of myself as an actor. I mean, I've been doing it since I was a teenager. I'm about to turn 46. It's almost 30 years. And it was this film, because just knowing how intense it was and what it would require of me, I didn't just do what I did in the past, which was like throw myself in and see what happens. I really was, I did things like I went to the gym and just it was very basic, just very literally shifted my energy at the end of the day so things couldn't remain stagnant inside me.
And part of that is based on this specific project, I'm sure. When you read the script of this
project.
One, again, we're not going to get into spoiler stuff, but like if you see the trailers, you'd get a sense of like the intensity of the entire material, let alone the arc of this character, this is not the role, if you're Daniel Day-Lewis method actor, you would kill yourself on the project like this. There needs to be some degree of,
I think there's some confusion about what method acting is. I literally looked it up the other day because I was like,
what is this anyway?
Yeah, well, I think that it came about at a time, Stanislavski came about with this method acting after a period of, filmmaking was new and the acting was really presentational.
Yes.
So the basic idea behind it is to align yourself so closely with a character that it feels completely honest. And I mean, I think that's what I try to do, but I think method acting and what people feel method acting might be is that one tortures oneself, right. And you know, there is no way in the world someone can completely immerse themselves in a character and in that character's world. It is impossible to let, just psychologically impossible.
There are cameras right there.
And I mean, you're going to text your friend and you're going to, have to stand in the shower by yourself and you are, it's just...
Yeah, Abraham Lincoln wasn't standing in the shower ordering breakfast. Yeah, so
I don't like the idea of method acting. It just feels indulgent because, I mean, any... actor worth their salt is going to try and make their performance as honest as possible.
That's at the end of the day, that's the goal for any actor. Yeah. How you get there is how you get there. But yes, it does seem, I don't know, I've talked to enough actors and I think it seems like a trait sometimes of young actors who don't know any better. It feels like,
and I fell into
work.
That as well.
I'm doing work.
Yeah,
I'm
when
hurting
you feel, really feel the grit, then it feels somehow like it's more important or more profound or like you're really doing a job. But I don't think that's necessary. And I certainly didn't do that on this movie. I felt it between action and cut, and then I really pushed it away.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and I think of, I love all stripes of actors, and I think, on the one hand, certain kinds of actors I think the best ones often make it look effortless, right? And I think of someone like Anthony Hopkins or Gene Hackman. It just feels very just organic and full-bodied, and there's not a moment of thinking, even though I know they're a huge celebrity, there's not a moment of me seeing the wheels turn.
Once you see somebody's technique, you're drawn out of it, and that really is a disservice to the piece on the whole.
Yeah.
If you're taken out of the story, it ain't working.
So the breakthrough on this one is more about self-preservation, though.
I think so.
Not the actual what's happening between action and cut. I mean, that you know how to do and you've known how to do, but this is about taking care of Tony a little bit.
Yeah, that happened on this movie. I'm a grown-up now.
Was your family with you for this, or did it feel like the kind of thing? Do you try to keep your family around when...
Yeah, for most of my jobs, yes. But with this one, my kids were in school, so I was going back to LA on the weekends until the last week or two. Then they came to Utah. So I had the luxury of solitude during the week and then a completely different world on the weekends, yeah.
So are you good at saying no? Or are you like, is your default when you're reading a script, I'm going to love this or I'm going to look for a reason not to love it?
If I am thinking about it in any way, if I'm on the fence and trying to break it down intellectually, then I know I'm in trouble. It's usually, it bypasses my brain and there's just this knowledge that, oh my God, I have to do this. If I don't do this, something's going to die. it's that strong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's so how, like, generally speaking, how quickly into a script do you get that feel?
Pretty quickly.
Thing in your
but
stomach?
I'll always read it to the end because people put so much effort into it and, it's... Anything could happen. Anything, but more often than not, doesn't.
Yeah. Does something like this read as scary? Like,
Well, no. Initially, I was told I was being sent a genre film, and I started reading it. And I was like, there's been some mistake here. This is just. It was kind of beautiful. It was this frank kind of look at some real emotional pain. It's about this family grief. I think ultimately the film is about grief. But it was just so raw and natural. And then obviously, that goes somewhere else. And it just totally still fascinates me that Ari was able to make what is very much a horror film, but to base it in something so real. It's really, all of us. It is the human condition.
It is bizarrely, after people see this film, they'll know what I'm talking about. It's like, it is bizarrely relatable, even considering the horrific...
Yeah,
things
and
that
I think
happen.
He's really clever in that respect because he makes you feel for them. You empathize so greatly and you invest in them and then you are taken somewhere completely unexpected. And I think that makes the film even scarier.
In some ways, it's about, what we pass on, what we inherit from our parents. And I think, most of us are fall into this trap. It's not like a trap, but it's just the reality of like when you're a kid, you view your parents as... parents. They are what they are to you and not independent
humans existing in the world. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. I'm curious, just like relating it to your own life. Like, was there a shift when you kind of started to think of your parents as not just your parents, but as adults that had a life before you were around?
Yes, of course. Yeah, I mean, don't you think that happens for everyone? Yeah. It has to happen in order for a child to become an independent, autonomous person. But yeah, I love my parents so much, and there was a point in my life where I actually thought, how will I ever love anyone else this much? I'm just was so, you know, they're very different to each other, and they're both so loving and supportive in different ways. And they make a great couple as well. There's so much to admire about them, and they've had some really, really difficult things happen in their lives. And I think for anyone to overcome their own personal crap in order to, you know, there's always going to be a certain amount of emotional baggage that you somehow inherit from your sure. parents. I mean, it's just a matter of to what extent, yes. really. I mean, it's par for the course. It's just part of what mm-hmm. it is. But they really, you know, had a lot to overcome, and I think we gather ancestral, you know, it's in the blood. It's mm-hmm. it's. Someone told me this morning they went to this healer and they looked at her blood and could see like a specific viral thing from like generations before. It was just a strain of it, but it was like, yep, got to get that out. And like, nothing to do with her immediate experience with her own family. Yeah. And that just fascinates me.
Did and then you go to the next generation. You have two kids, I believe.
I do,
is that
yeah,
right?
Yep.
You must, and they're at an age where, I mean, you know, from the start, I don't have kids myself, but you know, I'm sure as they grow up, you're seeing more and more of yourself and also independence. And like, are there traits of yours that you're surprised to see as your kids grow up into their
own individuals? It's really weird for me. I can see my husband in my kids, but I find it really hard to see myself in them. But other people say that they see me in them. Mm-hmm. And I've had moments where, I remember in my 20s, I was walking down an aisle in a grocery store in London and I felt like my mother from the inside. It was the strangest thing. And
it wasn't like seeing it in a mirror. It was
internalized
it.
Internal
it.
Feeling. Yeah. And that's happened maybe half a dozen times in my entire life. And the other day I kind of walked up to a table where a bunch of my friends were sitting and I was just kind of stood at the end and they were like, oh my God, you are so your daughter right now. So it kind of works yeah. both ways.
Have either of your kids faked appendicitis yet?
I really hope they never hear that story, but
I mean, I hesitate to regurgitate a story that I read on Wikipedia or IMDb and I hear on a talk show, but it's just so telling and remarkable, this story, that it should be repeated in every interview, frankly.
What does
you ever
it tell
do.
You? I mean, it's so embarrassing. Yes, I faked appendicitis so much so it got to the point where they removed the organ from my body. I did have a pain in my stomach. My mother had her appendix removed at the same age and I thought, oh, I'll just give this a go and see what happens. And it just got out of hand. And I mean, it's a long time ago. I don't quite understand the thought process behind it, if there was one. And I'm embarrassed to say that I think it probably was to gain attention.
It wasn't. Was it trying to get out of like school work?
That too.
Because I can relate to this. I was like a massive truant. And
you were?
And, oh my God.
See, I wasn't. I was a good girl. I was really good at school and I applied myself. I actually was one of those weirdos who enjoyed school. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, in leaving school in year 11, that was so shocking to my parents. But I had found acting and I knew it was my thing. I can't believe I made that decision. But
what did they make of it when you sort of intensified your love of acting? Did it catch them off guard? Were they supportive? Was it sort of like, let's see this run its course? But
well, my parents were, you know, they said, well, why don't you just stay at school and you can kind of dabble in it on the side. And, you know, there's that quote that parents throw at their kids, like, it's good to have a backup. You want to have a backup plan. So have your dream, but have something a little more grounded in reality. But I was a very strong-willed, I still am a strong-willed female, and I knew it's what I wanted to do. And I think I had done my first film and a few plays. I went to drama school for a little while, and then I was doing a production of Uncle Vanya opposite Geoffrey Rush at the you know, beloved opera house in Sydney for the Sydney Theatre Company. And I remember my father afterwards just saying, okay, I get it, you know. So it took them experiencing that to build, you know, what, telling them, sometimes telling somebody, you kind of, it doesn't work. You have to kind of show them.
Did, I mean, do you remember what that felt like the first couple of times you were on stage or being in these kind of larger productions? And like, was it a rush? Was it a...
Oh yeah. I felt so alive, so awake. And, I loved it. That, I mean, I guess that is what the addictive part of it was. I also remember, like, the first real, no, not real, it was a school production, but the real experience I had of acting was both kind of petrifying but also a relief. My grandmother had died just before this school production, and I was nervous to perform, you know, and also it was a musical, so I was singing, and it was Godspell, and there was a scene where Jesus died and all of the other characters were mourning, and I used the opportunity to channel so much pain that I was going through. And so initially I think my relationship with acting was very much about expressing things that I couldn't figure out how to navigate otherwise. Sure. And so that in itself was like, oh, what a great thing.
Superpower I have to deal with stuff.
Yeah.
Did you feel like, here's one thing that I discovered when I was just looking at the filmography. Your first film had a crazy cast, right? There was some amazing performers. Like, was Ben Mendelsohn a contemporary of yours?
That was the first job I did with Ben. It's a film called Spotswood, which was retitled The Efficiency Expert in America, which is, you know, titled
sounds like
grab
a Steven Seagal movie
get
or something.
You into the cinema. But it was Anthony Hopkins, Ben Mendelsohn, Russell Crowe, and a bunch of other amazingly talented people. Yeah. And it was my first time away from home. I was 17. I was living in Melbourne for a couple of months. I had my own apartment. I was given money, you know, and I was meeting all these incredible people. And I was pinching myself. And you know what? I still pinch myself because I, you know, my very, very last job was a film with Dan Gilroy. We were shooting at the Hollywood Forever Cemetery. I remember getting in the car at the end of the day and driving out of the cemetery and directly up the road that is perpendicular to the cemetery that you drive out of is the Hollywood sign. And I still get a kick out of the fact that I am on the other side of the world.
Crazy.
Because I loved TV and film when I was a kid. And to actually be being allowed to do it, it still kind of blows my mind at times.
I was going to make another triple X joke, but I decided against it.
Yeah, let's not do that. We've been
When did... So did you feel like you had a class of, like, actors that you kind of came of age with? Like, the... that, like, the Ben Mendelsohns, the Russell Crowes, was there a fraternity?
They seemed ahead of me. They're a bit older than me, and I always felt a little kind of beneath them, and not beneath them, but, you know, younger than them and slightly intimidated, like they knew more than I did. I often feel like other people know more than I do, but that's changed in the last, I don't know, 10 years.
I'm trying to find an apple.
Sitting in a puddle here. I opened a bottle of water, and
we
now
should find something for you.
It
so
doesn't matter. It's not on me, and it's not
touching.
You're okay?
Yeah,
you
promise?
Totally fine.
Okay.
Yeah.
So was the dream or was there an aspiration of getting to America, getting to Hollywood movie making?
Not at all. I just loved either being on set or being on stage, and it was an experience unto itself. When I did Muriel's Wedding, I had zero concept of an audience, really.
Well, no one had any expectation for that film to go as worldwide as it did,
I assume. Yeah, but I also had no idea of... I wasn't planning a career. It was literally one foot in front of the other, and... it was a combination of, you know, it was really dumb luck and you know, application. Muriel's Wedding was, I remember the first time I watched it, because I hadn't, you know, these days I get sent a copy or there's a, you know, a screening.
Yeah.
And suddenly I was flown to the other side of the world. I was a bit jet lagged, which felt a bit trippy. And I was sitting in a cinema of over a couple of thousand people in Cannes, and then there's this massive screen and there I am up there, and it was really strange because...
the human brain is not equipped to deal with that kind
of... No, it ain't. But I did this thing where I literally relived every scene. I just sat there laughing and sobbing, and it was one of the wildest experiences of my life. And, yeah, I guess I've never really had expectations or plans, and I think the fact that I am... open to what the universe throws at me somehow has allowed various experiences because I've never tried to control it.
Well, Exhibit A, what you were just saying about Hereditary, looking for the light comedy, but be ready for the dark psychological horror film.
A little bit of grief.
A little bit, to say the least. So And Muriel was also, is also curious because that I think that's your second film.
Yes, it is, yeah.
You're obviously the lead in that film. And did that feel like, was ignorance kind of bliss, like in terms of just being the lead of your own film at 19 or 20, whatever you were
at the time? Yeah, I was 20, yeah.
It didn't feel like overwhelming at the time. It just felt like this is a ride and I'm just going to take it.
Look, when I read that, it was the same. It was this. Not every job has this. I mean, there are things I do because it'll feel creatively satisfied, but there are a handful of jobs which feel like they are preordained life experiences that I have to have. It felt like a religious experience. I cannot tell you how. There are so many people who look at that character and they're fond of her, and then there are others who are like, I am Muriel. And I think I myself fell into the, you know, latter category. And it was just, it was life-changing on so many levels, yeah.
What happened in the wake of that? I mean, I know what happened by looking at the filmography and the kind of films you followed it up with, but I'm just curious, like, did that immediately have you coming to Hollywood and doing a spate of meetings and kind of like, or did it feel like there was new opportunity immediately, or was there a lag time? I'm just curious, like, where...
Well, Miramax picked up the film at Cannes, and then, you know... They did an amazing job of distributing the film. I think as I get older, I realize how important marketing is. People need to know that it is a business, and people need to know that the film exists. And they did a really, really great job. So I traveled to so many festivals all around Europe and America, and I had a bunch of meetings in LA. The film industry is quite small compared to the film industry in America. I found a great agent and manager, and then the whole machine starts kicking in. You start reading things and getting offers. But I think initially I was getting either offered roles that were lead roles that were kind of similar to Muriel, or smaller roles in other films because people were kind of excited to work with me but didn't quite know how to kind of fit me in. So I did a few roles kind of in that vein.
Worked with Matt Reeves before he was Matt Reeves on The Pallbearer. Yes, that's kind of crazy, that movie. People forget that movie, frankly, exists because he kind of like reinvented himself all these years later.
Right, exactly. That was amazing to suddenly, like, honestly, I grew up outside of Sydney, and then to find myself in New York. New York is like this, you know, I mean, when I first got here, I really was that kind of wide-eyed out-of-towner who's, like, got my face pressed against the window, totally amazed by the fact that the cabs are yellow and there is steam coming out of the road. It was just so full of clichés, but they're so familiar and it's so exciting as a tourist.
I grew up here in New York, so I've been here forever, and I recall seeing The Wild Party. So that must have been a big moment for you, too. I mean, judging by what you just said in terms of what New York meant to you, and I know music is obviously something very close to your heart, to have that kind of opportunity.
Yeah, I started in musicals. I mean, I started singing kind of led to a love of acting, and The Wild Party was a new piece. It was so crazy that there were two productions being mounted at the exact same time. But I worked with incredible people. I love George Wolfe. He's the most wonderful director. Amazing. So passionate and with such infectious energy.
Was that the production? Yours had Eartha Kitt?
I was working with Eartha Kitt and Mandy Patinkin and a bunch of other really, really incredible people. And it was very satisfying, completely exhausting. I don't know how people sustain a Broadway career, because the amount of energy that you have to put out night after night is just, I mean, theatre itself is amazing, but if you're hoofing it and singing, like, it's just, it's like, I think I remember at the time feeling like it's a kind of militant experience. You have to be so, so disciplined. I walked past, actually, I was walking back to my hotel the other night. I walked past the Public Theatre.
Yeah.
And I felt such a fondness. And I was just really remembering, I mean, that time, and even just like experiencing snow. I mean, I was running around in trainers. I didn't know how to dress myself properly. It was all so new and novel, even at that time. But I remember this, like when we first started, and there was one of my numbers, which was, it was almost like this woman who's like blabbing, she can't stop, da, 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 and there's a lot of movement to it. And when we first started doing it, I remember just feeling so exhausted by it. And then by the time, you know, you get to the end of the rehearsal period, you are like master of it. You could do it standing on your head.
Yeah.
And just the sheer physicality of it and the resistance that you build up is inevitable because you're putting the effort in, but it's fascinating.
It's amazing because, like, I try to see a lot of theater if I can here, and it's like I can fool myself when I'm watching a movie or TV show, like, oh, I could do that. You know, we could all do that. You know, I could do it once or twice.
Yeah,
but then
right.
You're at the theater and you see Angels in America and you see, like, you know, someone just like, I mean,
it's
8
like
hours
the acting
of
Olympics.
It is. It's not, it's a superpower. It's crazy.
Yes.
you surprisingly haven't had the opportunity, I presume, to do much in the way of movie musicals itself. I mean, like, Connie and Carlo is probably the closest you've come.
Yeah, right.
Is that something that you've... I mean, you've talked about sort of not, like, you know, kind of... You can't steer your own ship too much in this industry, but, like, is that something that you wish or still hope to kind of...
I really do.
Yeah,
but,
do more of?
I mean, I think musicals have got a bad name, and rightly so. Some of them are shocking, but when they are tastefully done and when there's something real to latch onto and the music will enhance the story and it can be quite profound and joyous. It depends on the story, but I very basically just miss singing and I still write some music, but it's, you know, my day job has very much got me kind of busy.
Yeah. I can only imagine the music you're writing during Hereditary on your off time. It's your dark material, the dark works of Toni Collette.
Yeah, that'd be a nice volume.
Is there like a pie in the sky musical that's still kind of on your bucket list to tackle, or just one that you love as a fan that in recent years that did touch you, that did kind of work for you?
No, to be honest, no. But there's always new work that's coming
around. Well, you're open
around.
To it. Yeah,
I really am. Yeah.
So Sixth Sense is always mentioned, as it should be, because it's a great piece of work. I watched it again the other day because it holds up so well. I've always been a fan of Knights. So people are drawing parallels on a surface level, and it's really just a surface level to Hereditary. They couldn't be more different.
Oh, it's a completely
films.
Different film,
couldn't
but I can
different.
See the similarities for sure.
And certainly in filmmakers, like where they're at in their career. Your filmmaker in this one is a first-time filmmaker, and by the way, the confidence he shows behind the camera of this is remarkable.
Yeah,
and
agree.
Similarly, Knight
was at the beginning of his career. It was his second film,
exactly.
Yeah.
And I'm always, when I look at his work from Sixth Sense on, I always see, like, a certitude, this is a guy that, for good or for bad, he has a vision and he's taking you on a ride. Mm-hmm. Did you sense that, like, going in? He was a young man.
Yes.
And is that a high for an actor? It must be.
Absolutely. With both Ari and Knight, there was a complete clarity of vision and it stood alone. It was original and it felt strong.
Yeah.
And, I mean, you'd be surprised the amount of directors who don't realize that they are in charge.
Yeah.
Like, there needs to be some, you know, it is a very collaborative medium and I am really open to the idea of everyone working together. But the director has to be at the helm. Somebody has to steer the ship.
Yeah.
Those guys, yeah, both of them. Wow.
Did I have a great fondness for About a Boy.
Oh, yeah.
You had not one but two directors on that one, Chris and Paul
Chris
White.
Chris and Paul are amazing.
I was going to say, actually, like, one thing that struck me when I was rewatching Sixth Sense, you played a mom at a very young age. Like, you were...
I was 24. In fact, I remember I turned 25 during the shoot because there was a little surprise birthday lunch thrown for me.
It caused all different, very different sort of roles, but you played a mom many times in those years, it feels like.
Yeah, I really did.
Was that something that struck you as fine, the parts are good? Was it, I mean, this was...
Yeah, the parts were great, and it was an opportunity to show that these were all, you know, vastly different people, and they happened to be, you know, mothers as well. Which
yeah, they couldn't be more different than the About a Boy character from, obviously... Any of them, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, clearly. Were you shocked as everybody else when Nick Holt turned into, like, Superman? Like, one day, we didn't see him for, like, 5 years, and all of a sudden we saw him and he was, like, 7'3" and looked like Christopher Reeve. It was, like, crazy.
Yes, it was crazy. I mean, I remember seeing him a year after making the movie and we were, you know, back together doing press and just being blown away by how much he'd grown, let alone that huge leap. He is a beautiful boy. Honestly, a sweet, sweet
heart.
He's
a great guy. I love him.
But my God, he's a hottie as well.
Can't be denied.
It's so bizarre.
another film that really touches people. I don't even know what the box office was, but who cares at this point? It's the last lasting powers in her shoes.
Oh.
Which
I loved making that movie. Curtis Hanson.
I love Curtis Hanson. Look at his filmography. My God, a guy that could do anything.
It's so varied and so... So, I mean, honestly, that's another... I mean, people have drawn similarities between Knight and Ari, and they may be a little more obvious, but I have to say I find similarities between Curtis and Ari, because Curtis is someone who is just... I think I feel safest as an actor, and I feel like I can really be as vulnerable as I need to be to make something real, only when the director feels just as dedicated and married right. and saturated in the story as I am. And... Curtis was definitely all of those things. My God, we had a 2-week rehearsal period. That never happens. And I thought this is going to be a waste of time. I'm going to play pin the tail on a donkey or something.
Got this on day 2.
But it was so thorough.
Yeah.
And Ari is so thorough. They are so in their heads and beautifully so. It's so inspiring. And it's about clarity and it's about depth. It's about really understanding how people work. And being not only having the understanding inside their own skulls, but being brilliant communicators, being able to articulate exactly what they want.
Yeah.
It becomes infectious. You know, it's really inspiring when you work with someone that you feel gets things on a really, really deep level.
I've asked this along these lines, this kind of question to actors over the years, because I'm always curious, because this kind of line of thinking comes up a lot, where like, yes, you need somebody that both has the passion and the vision. And what does an actor do on day 2 or 3 when they realize, oh my God, I was sold a bill of goods. This guy doesn't have
it. He's a hack.
Like, how do you preserve, how do you save yourself?
I am a very hopeful person. So much so that sometimes I read scripts and even when in reading the script, I think, oh, I can make that better. And so I always do really hope for the best. Once you're already in it, I'm still
commit.
As dedicated.
There's
no point not doing that. It's just not going to serve anybody. So, you know, you make the most of it and get through it. I mean, it's only happened a handful of times, so I've been very lucky. And, yes, I will knock on wood. But, yeah, for me, that has been rare, and I'm very thankful for that. Because it is a bit soul-destroying. I have one job, which is, like, the worst job of my life, and I just...
I won't name it, but I think because you mentioned it's a New York shoot, right? That was here.
Yes.
Yeah. So what do you learn as much from those kinds of experiences as the successes in terms of like what warning signs to look for when you go into a shoot, or is it just sort of like it's the law of averages. No actor is ever going to, you know, escape unscathed in their resume.
I think for me that really made me, I think it's really important to know why you are taking a job. So if you have your own ideas that you want to address, or you know, then that can be achieved despite the experience, you know.
Right.
So you just need to be clear about what you actually want out of it.
We kind of alluded to this at the start, but like, what has this been like? You've been talking your head off, and rightfully so.
It is on the floor.
you're remarkably coherent given how much you're talking about this film. But it must be heartening to have some perspective to kind of like be on the roller coaster a few times and to sort of know. I mean, you alluded to this.
I know it's all swings and roundabouts. This is not my first barbecue, and
right.
I have to say it is a totally fascinating experience, and I'm really excited for Ari. He looks to me and says, is this normal? Is this? And I'm like, Ari, no, it ain't. So enjoy it, because it's not always like this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So having said that, and having said that you can't kind of like steer your own ship too much, you just finished this film with Dan Gilroy.
Dan Gilroy, yes.
I get all the Gilroys confused. Yeah. Too many talented Gilroys out there. You shot a TV series, I believe, correct?
I did, Wanderlust? Yeah. It's a BBC Netflix co-production called Wanderlust, which we shot in Manchester, which I loved. Nick Payne, who's a brilliant playwright, wrote every episode, and it was... I mean, I'm so lucky. I think it really is all about the material for me, and just working with good writing is such a pleasure, and I feel so privileged. It's just, you know, really... special.
And by the way, and apologize for the construction on our building
here. And people need to get their work done.
I just saw Brett Haley's Heartbeats Loud,
yes.
which is a sweet, wonderful movie.
Isn't it gorgeous?
And Nick's doing the podcast in a couple of days.
Oh,
Nick
great.
Offerman. And that's, again, you got to shoot that here in New York.
I know, it was so much fun. It was a completely different experience. I guess it was the kind of experience I'd hoped for before I did Hereditary.
If at first you don't
because
succeed,
it was so easy. It was so much fun. Right. You know, it's not really my movie. It's Nick and Kiersey, and it's gorgeous, and it has like these, it has some depth and poignancy, and it's moving, but it's also like truly elating. It's just got such a light, positive vibe to it, and to be a part of that just felt like a little gift. It was so much fun.
And I know you're ramping up in terms of producing. That's something that you're prioritizing going forward. Yes.
Yeah, I really am. I've been optioning some material, and you know, some pieces are being adapted. I've got some original ideas, and so I'm producing, but I also do want to direct. I think we have found something.
Oh, nice.
That I would like to direct. So it's just it's all a jigsaw, and things happen in their own time, and I trust that, and that's part of the process. I'm not trying to ram experiences. There also needs to be time of no work, because that's that feeds your work as well.
Right.
And I need to go and at the end of this, I'm just going to go and it's my kids finish school on Friday.
Nice.
And I am putting my phone away, and I just cannot wait to just be with them and do not much.
I'm going to take the hint, and I'm going to let you live your life.
No,
it's all good. I'm totally teasing you. I remain such a fan of your work, and I'm so happy for you on this project. This
oh, is you're so lovely. Thank you.
Truly a special one. Hereditary. It's out in theaters. So we're going to publish this, I think, a day or two before it comes out. So by the time you listen to this, it's probably out. Go see it. I only saw about 80% of it because my hands were over my face for a little bit of it. So I look forward to seeing the entire thing.
Oh, that's funny.
But it's a hell of a piece of work, and I hope you enjoy this the silly ride that it is.
Oh, thank you.
I'll see you on the next one. Thank you, Tony.
All right, cheers.
And so ends another edition of Happy, Sad, Confused. Remember to review, rate, and subscribe to this show on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm a big podcast person. I'm Daisy Ridley, and I definitely wasn't pressured to do this by Josh.
'Tried reading while jogging, cooking, or even juggling flaming torches? Yeah, doesn't end well. But with audiobooks.com, you can conquer books without the circus act. Dive into over 450,000 titles, including more than 10,000 free ones. Get hooked on a bestseller, find your next obsession, or finally read that classic you've been avoiding since high school. And here's the inside scoop. Sign up today for a free 30-day trial and snag your first three audiobooks on the house. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.